Okay, thank you, Maud, for the introduction, and also thank you for inviting me to this whole process. I found it to be very new and exciting. As Maud said, I don't have a philosophy background. My background is in animal behavior. I'm getting ready to finish my PhD in animal behavior at the University of California, Davis, where I've focused in particular on the evolution of cognitive systems, and even more in particular, on the role of the distribution of fruit in the environment, on the evolution of primate cognition, and the cognition of other animals that have evolved in similar environments. And I will say that in the course of completing my dissertation, I remain amazed by how much of my time I spent developing technology, technology for measuring, technology for analyzing, technology for communicating. And so when Maud suggested we read this book, and I saw it was about the role of technology in science, and in particular that it addressed ideas of knowledge and modeling and cognition, I was really, really excited to jump in. And now I have found that I have jumped in way into the deep end. This presentation has a lot of ideas in it, too many ideas, and there's a kind of latent motivation behind it to make an argument toward a claim that I've actually taken out because I don't think I do a great job, but I'm really grateful to get to go after Thomas because I think he set it up really well. So I'm gonna state that claim now and hopefully you can trace some of the threads of it through this presentation. And that is that at the level of abstraction in which it is useful to think of an epistemic agent as an object that co-produces knowledge, it is also useful to create a concept of a cognitive agent, which by definition produces knowledge of itself, and that it is possible to know what another cognitive agent knows of itself. So that's a huge claim, and it's gonna take a huge argument, and I've also gone into this presentation with some more achievable goals. And so that includes reviewing and reconstructing Rousseau's concept of re-diem knowledge, that is knowledge that is relational, distributed, embodied, and material, to deploy episodes of animal cognition research to contextualize the relationship between knowledge, cognition, and agency, and finally to pose the question, what can we know about animal knowledge? And so as we get set up, I've got some key concepts for us to think about on the way through. Naturally, the most important of these are these attributes that Rousseau applies to knowledge, that it has relations, it is distributed, it is embodied, and knowledge is material. And at the same time, I want to introduce some key concepts from cognition. The idea of cognitive maps, the idea of theory of mind, the idea of engrams, and the idea of episodic memory. And I'm gonna go through some of these concepts in an order that is different from Rousseau's book, because I believe that the order of these ideas in the cognition side of things have a hierarchical structure that leads to the emergence of the type of agency that Thomas talked about in his talk. And of course, if we want to build a full notion of the idea of knowledge and cognition, all of these concepts have to hang together. But I'm going to emphasize some of the relationships that I think are most important. And as I do, I'm going to bring up some of these episodes from animal behavior that I think can highlight the relationship between notions of knowledge and notions of cognition. And so I'll start with some discussion of rats and mazes to talk about engrams and embodiment. I'll move to an episode I call To Banana or Not to Banana to talk about episodic memory and materiality. And then I'll move up to cognitive maps and relations and kind of an extended episode called Where's the Food, where I'll start by talking about inference and uncertainty and then move into resource mapping to bring this talk into ideas of distribution and theory of mind. And hopefully I'll be able to hang it all together and ask about the relationship between the cognitive agents and the epistemic agents. And so I want to jump into this by the tracing that Rousseau made of the phenomenological tradition in embodied cognition, in which she primarily leans on the work of Varela and Thompson and Roche and their work Embodied Mind, as they trace the thoughts of Martin Heidegger, Edmund Husserl, and Maurice Merleau-Ponty, as well as the Buddhist tradition. And I want to jump in here because it parallels my only other previous experience with philosophy, which is a book called Phenomenology, An Introduction by Anthony Camero and Stephen Kaufer, and conversations I had with Seth Frey, a cognitive scientist at University of California, Davis, in the development of my proposal defense. And they trace this same lineage of phenomenological thought in the Western tradition. And I just want to come to some of Martin Heidegger's writings to set the foundation for how I want to talk about this and enrich the idea of embodiment in knowledge. And he says, as translated through this book, temporality temporalizes as a future which makes present in the process of having been. And I've selected that in part because it is classically convoluted for Heidegger. But I've translated it here to mean that human experience of the present is fundamentally oriented toward the future in a manner that is dictated by the past. And so we situate our knowledge in between the past and or the past and the future, and that is our experience of the present. And he further goes on to say that human behavior is driven by the perceived value of the objects around us or equipment in regard to achieving a projected conception of our future selves. And I think that this nicely relates to the idea that technology and instruments play in our role as scientists and the future we want to create. And I also want to take a moment to note, as I'm thinking about the role of animals in this relationship, that Heidegger writes that the human body is essentially something other than an animal organism, and claims that animals are poor in world, meaning they're unable to conceptualize themselves or the materials they perceive as being, and they're unable to experience the world as a human does. And I want to put this at kind of one end of the notions I'm going to trouble with these episodes of animal cognition. And so if we trace the idea of phenomenology, we can see it runs a little bit in parallel and separate from a more mentalist tradition starting with Descartes. And it also runs through a naturalist tradition starting with Darwin and then into psychology, these two schools, one with William James in the US and the other with Wilhelm Wundt in Germany. And Chimero argues that you can see in these two traditions the emergence of what he labels embodied cognitive science and radical embodied cognitive science, the RECS down here on the bottom. And I think that the distinction he makes here is really useful for us to understand what we mean by embodiment. And so starting with what these two have in common, which is that they're both phenomenological. They both have some degree of influence from this left school of thought coming from phenomenology. And the key point there is that mind, body, and environment are all elements of a single system, right? And this is a different notion from the representationalist idea that thinkers are separate from the environment and they have representations of the outside world around them. And I want to tie these also to the way that we might model these systems, thinking about the phenomenological approach as one that uses dynamical systems, and the representationalist approach as one, or the rationalist approach, mentalist approach, as one that uses representations. And this is where we can start to pull apart the radical embodied cognitive school, radical embodied cognitive science from the embodied cognitive science, where RECS, radical embodied cognitive science, says cognition can be modeled from a purely dynamical systems approach. There are no categories of thought, and places emphasis on the patterns of change in the mind-body-environment system and the behaviors they produce. So as a little example here, if we look at this middle image, which is our dynamical system as a field where the black dots are starting conditions in the mind-body-environment state, they will move through a process and eventually move toward a basin of attraction, so to speak, that produces a behavior in the organism, agent, animal, whatever you want to call it, right? In this case, I've illustrated it with, in some set of environments, the monkey accepts the cucumber and eats it. In another set of environments, it throws the cucumber back at its experimenter and says, no, thank you. We can then contrast this with embodied cognitive science, which says that dynamical systems are still helpful and help us understand cognition and behavior, but we can also use categories of thought and representations are useful for modeling behavior. And that embodied cognitive science identifies the presence or absence of meaningful units of thought in species or individuals. And so now I'm going to put on my brand new Rousseau glasses and try to reinterpret this to say that embodied cognitive science holds that at a given level of abstraction, categories of thought meaningfully describe the dynamical system governing a mind-body-environment process. And so this brings us to thinking about engrams as a case of how cognition can be embodied. And this idea can be traced back to Richard Simon, his zoologist and evolutionary biologist, again, thinking about the naturalist tradition that underlies the school of thought, coined the word meme, meaning the memory of an external to internal experience, coming from the name of the Greek goddess, and also the word engram, which he says is the physical manifestation of a meme, or the enduring, though primarily latent, modifications in the irritable substance produced by a stimulus. And he amusingly claims that to follow this into the molecular field seems to me a hopeless undertaking at the present stage of our knowledge, and for my part, I renounce the task. But yet, he held that from the behavior of animals, we could know this to be true. And so this brings me to Edward Tolman, who's somebody who's gonna come up a lot in my talk. He sets the foundation for me of embodied cognitive science, and also offers, I think, a very prescient phenomenological model of psychology and cognition. And if you know him, you may know him as a figurehead for Rats in Mazes, which is the episode we're going to talk about here. And he, in his book, Purposive Behavior in Rats and Men, he describes a wealth of different maze structures that he and collaborators and other scientists of the time put rats through to observe behavior that could not be described by the more traditional psychological take of the time of pure stimulus response action and learning, of pure reinforcement learning. And he describes behaviors like the use of shortcuts, where when a rat experienced in a maze was given a new option that would allow it to take a shorter route, it would immediately do so, suggesting it had built a knowledge of the relationship of its start point and end point, despite not having directly experienced that route. He also described maze-wise rats, which could navigate over through many mazes, and at the first maze they encountered, they would attend to all of the various stimuli in the maze. But over many experiences, they could be put in a new maze that was structured very differently, but they would still navigate it quickly because they understood the correct maze-appropriate features that attended them to the food they could expect at the end. And through this book, he comes to some really interesting conclusions, and I'll highlight a few of them here. One is that the ultimate goal objects for the rat or other animal are certain finally to be sought or to be avoided physiological states of quiescence and disturbance due to initiating physiological states or conditions. And so this brings us back to this dynamical systems approach to thinking about things and offers, I think, a very prescient phenomenological take. Note this is 5 years after Heidegger published Being and Time. And then he says that the environment takes on for the physiologically aroused organism, by dint of his innate endowment and past experience, the character of a hierarchy of to be sought and to be avoided superordinate and subordinate objects. And so I want to lay out a few definitions he makes that I think help us build a model of cognition that will be useful in understanding the emergence of agency. And one of the central concepts he uses is Seingestalt, which he describes as a complex behavior support consisting of a sign object or a means object, a signified object or a goal object, and a signified means-end relation. Or a distance direction correlation between such sign object and signified object. And so here he's building up knowledge of relationships between known entities. And then he builds off of Seimann's meme to describe a minimization, or one of three moods of Seingestalt expectation. In minimization, stimuli for the sign object only are present, but the stimuli for the signified object or signified means-end relation, the minimization for which is under consideration, have as such been specifically present one or more times in the past. So here he's suggesting a imminent cognitive determinant, an expectation or a physical manifestation of a non-present stimuli in the physiological state of an animal based on the presence of another stimuli it knows to be related. And I highlight this minimization here, again, because I think it emphasizes this fairly early approach toward the embodiment of cognition. But Tolman, like Simon before him, had no endeavor to actually identify the material aspects of this embodiment. He used behavior to make inferences about its existence. I want to briefly bring up Carl Lashley in this, because he was... He sought the engram by putting rats in mazes like Tolman. Particularly, he gave them very routine routes. So these rats became very good at solving mazes in particular ways. And then he lesioned their brain and found a correlation between the amount of mass removed and the degradation in the rat performance of the rat in the maze, but not the location. And so he deemed the engram elusive. Enter some new technology. In 1976, John O'Keefe used micro drive array, which has a series of micro electrodes, to measure the electrical excitement of individual neurons in the brains of rats that he put in simple radial arm mazes, like you can see in the bottom left here. And he found that some of these cells that were measured fired specifically when the rat was in certain places of the maze, and held that these cells encoded for place in the rat's brain. And he cited this as material evidence of Tolman's cognitive map theory emerging from his purposive behaviorism. And this has launched 40, 50 years now of intensive neuroscientific research into the behavior, distribution of place cells, and their relationships to other types of neurons in the brain. And I want to finish this episode by talking about some very recent research that has recalled the idea of the engram. And for this, I lean on a review by Shina Jocelyn and Susumu Tonegawa, who, through their research, have claimed that engrams are distributed neuron complexes, that they excited neurons are recruited to engrams during experience. And they use some really interesting studies to show this. I'm going to run through this as quickly as I can. What we can see here is they exposed rats to a learning condition where they paired a sound with a shock, and the rats learned to fear the sound for that association. At this time, they also injected a virus into the rat's brain that expressed two things: a transcription factor that excited the neuron, increased its neuronal excitability and dendritic spine density, and an inducible construct that could initiate cell autonomous death. And so what they were able to do then is experimentally manipulate the neurons that were recruited into engrams during the learning experience and later targeted kill those cells. And when they did this versus when they killed random cells that weren't the ones excited into the engram, they showed significant degradation in the memory of the fear-inducing learning event. And so I think this offers some really interesting evidence of the embodiment of cognition. And they state here that an engram is not yet a memory, but rather provides the necessary physical conditions for a memory to emerge. And that they note a really interesting property, which is that the number of neurons in an engram is relatively stable and does not influence the strength of the memory. Rather, preferential engram cell to engram cell connection is the critical part of the enduring changes to an engram created during learning. Okay, so real quick, I'm going to put back on my Rousseau glasses again and try to reinterpret this background context. And note that we've got a few interesting things going on here. We have at least one epistemic agent doing scientific study on the rats and building evidence of their knowledge of place through the instrument of the maze, which has a different role in the scientist versus the rat. But we've also seen that the scientist has built knowledge of embodied knowledge. And I've noted that I've circled here also this microdrive array as a potential epistemic agent in the production of that knowledge. All right, so episode 2, to banana or not to banana. And I'm gonna cruise through this pretty quickly. But I want to highlight Rousseau's definition here of knowledge as a product of techno-scientific activities carried out by epistemic agents. It is often expressed in propositional form in natural languages. It is also encapsulated in material objects and situated with respect to a number of social, cultural, or material aspects. And so there's four ways to look at this. We can think about the materiality of scientific experiments and instruments. We can think about the materiality of embodiment, We can think about the materiality of agency, and we can think about the materiality of virtual knowledge. And we've already seen some of these come up in our previous example. There's materiality in the instruments used to measure the place cells in the rat, and there's materiality in the embodiment of knowledge through n-grams. But n-grams build into memory, as we have discussed. And the work by the folks I mentioned before, Tolving and Sudendorf and Corballis, follows from Heidegger's idea of the human experience, which is that our memories are episodic. And that doesn't just mean that we go back in time, but that we use our past experiences to project ourselves to the future. And that it is the advancement of memory from procedural, in which specific actions are reinforced through positive or negative valence of experience, to this more flexible system of memory that allows us to generalize across contexts and place ourselves into possible futures. And there's some really interesting research that's been done on the episodic memory in primates. Charles Menzel worked with the Japanese macaques in the Osaka Prefectural Park in Minu, and noted that they responded very differently to non-native bananas than to the native akebi fruit, and specifically that when an individual in the group was exposed to found banana, it would eat the banana, and then at a later point, it might come back to where it found it and search on the ground for it. Whereas if an individual found akebi fruit, it would look up toward the trees, it would travel off, it would investigate unripe akebi vines. And so the finding of akebi fruit suggested that it was projecting into a possible future where it could find akebi fruit based on its past experiences with the fruit in those trees. And it's worth noting that Charles Menzel put this fruit in many different locations. And so there is no clear way that the animal could have a procedural memory of getting from location where it found the akebi to the location where it investigated for akebi. And Charles Jansen has done something similar at a broader scale by placing bananas at different renewal rates in feeding stations across a research state with capuchin monkeys, and finding that the decisions they make in traveling from site to site suggest knowledge of how long it has been since they were last there, and thus maximizing the rewards they can get by visiting sites that they have been away from the longest and that they know to have faster renewal, suggesting that capuchins have memory that implies what, when, and where they've had experiences. And I will state that in animal cognition research, we often use the term episodic-like to describe behavior that shows these properties. And the reason for that comes from the notion of autopoiesis that Tolving says is an essential element of the way humans experience episodic memory, which says that we put ourselves in those memories and we understand them in relation to ourself. And there's a lot of debate about whether or not this is true of the episodic-like memory in animals. So looking back at this with our glasses, we can say that scientific experiments and instruments have materiality, and I want to present the interesting idea that in this case, we are using the capuchin, or the animal, as an instrument to study knowledge. We've already talked about embodiment and materiality. I think one of the most challenging notions of Red-EM knowledge is this idea that agency has materiality in some cases, especially when we apply agency to our instruments. And so I want to take a moment to look at this from the perspective of if we see this dynamical system as our scientists' mind-body-environment system, that the presence of the instrument in that scientist's environment has an impact on that initial state, and therefore it has agency on the action of the scientist. And that action is what has agency. And finally, I think a useful example of this virtual knowledge has materiality comes from the notion that I have never been to Iguazu. I had no role in this experiment, and I have only ever read this paper online. And yet I have knowledge, or I produce knowledge of this that has been transmitted to me virtually. All right, so now we ask, where is the food? And what does this have to do with cognitive maps and relation? And I want to start by noting something very interesting about the relationship between place cells and n-gram cells, which is that they are not necessarily the same, but they can be. So there are place cells included in n-grams. And this ties to Tolman's notion of the cognitive map, in that place cells give context to our memories, and they are the embodiment of what situates our memories in space and time. And we can think about this in terms of knowledge being relational at the level of actors, the level of objects, the level of relations between epistemic agents in the world, and the level of concepts. And instead of doing all of these individually, I want to come back to Tolman and read a passage from his book that I think applies the level of abstraction notion to the idea of relations in a way that really suits the conversations we had in our discussions as tying together physics, philosophy, and psychology. And this relies heavily on the idea of inference, which is similar to nemonization, except that the animal has never experienced the expectation that is manifest in an inference. It assumes, or it creates that knowledge based on an understanding of the relations with other relations in the world. And this is what allows an animal to be flexible in its behavior. And Tolman says that in the building up of the present system, we have attempted to do for psychological phenomena what the other sciences have done for physical phenomena. We have attempted to reduce the former to a series of functional relationships by virtue of which it is possible to predict and control. In place of the concrete but ineffable richness of real experience as it comes, i.e. our hopes, our feelings, our images, our thoughts, we have substituted a barren and unfelt array of functionally defined immanent determinants and behavior adjustments. As scientists, we started with real, rich, immediate experience, but in the interest of prediction and control, we've ended up with demands, means and readiness, sign-gestalt expectations, and the rest. But this distortion of realities of immediate experience is, we should suppose, no more violent and repulsive than that which is pursued by the physicist or the chemist. These thinkers likewise start with rich concrete realities, chairs, tables, clocks, dye stuff. But in the interests of prediction and control, they end with electrons and protons, or is it waves? All science necessarily presents, it seems to us, but a map and a picture of reality. If I were to present reality in its whole concreteness, science would not be a map, but a complete replica of reality, which ties to our mind our duplicate climate system. And then it would lose its usefulness, for it would have to cover as many pages as does life itself. It would no longer serve as a brief and a handbook. One of the first requisites of a science is, in short, that it be a map, i.e. a shorthand for finding one ways about from moment of reality to the next, that it be a symbolic compendium by means of which to predict and control. Our account of the mind, we hold, is a map account. And in this way, I think he ties the notion of the relatedness of knowledge at the concept level and the way we build a cognitive map in our heads, so to speak, to the notion of the relation of knowledge at a actor level, where we use science to also make a map of the world around us. And I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip ahead of the first part of our Where is Food episode and go straight to the more exciting part, which is where I have tried to take the aspects of cognition that I've talked about and studied in laboratory research into the field and begin to think about the ways we can study them in a system that is big and continuous and does not have discrete decisions and well-defined tasks. And so work by my dissertation advisor and her colleagues and I collected data from 46 individual animals of four different species, free-ranging on an island in Panama. And so we have data, movement data over 3 months here from spider monkeys, capuchins, coatis, and kinkajous. And we collected this data at a time where if we zoom in on one of these paths, this belongs to Tony Stark here. We've zoomed in. And we've also used flights and aerial photography to capture the locations of every single tree of the species Dipteryx oleifera, which is the only species known to produce large quantities of fruit during the season we track these animals. And so in this sense, we've built some macroscopic knowledge of where the food resources are of these animals over the course of 3 months and where the animals were during that time as well. And if we think about the technologies playing a role in this, there's a lot. We have our GPS collars, which use satellites. They collect information about the distance from multiple satellites to locate themselves relative to those satellites, and thus we gain knowledge about the location of the animals. And as a quick anecdote about the role that distributed embodied knowledge can have, I recently learned a month ago that the manufacturer of our GPS collars does not make the GPS chips. And in fact, they do not know how the GPS chips work. The manufacturers of those chips have built algorithms in that help them to infer the location of the animal based on its movement before and after the points that it has already collected. But there's problems with this algorithm that manifest themselves in ideas like ghost trajectories, where they assume that if there's motion due to error and you're sitting still, they'll smooth that out into a nicely looped track that looks like your animal has done something meaningful. And so now I have to go back and rethink some of our data because that distributed knowledge had not reached me. And so what I've done is an analysis on these data to look at how learning has occurred in their trajectories. And so the first thing I've done is I've taken all of the movement paths and I've clustered the fixes we get from these GPS fix using an algorithm that has a two-part process. First, I look at which of the GPS fixes are highly recursive, meaning that the animal leaves the region for a certain amount of time and then comes back to them more often than other locations. And then from those highly recursive locations, I've used a clustering algorithm to say, what are the spatial polygons we can use to infer important regions to this animal, places that it knows and comes back to? And then I've used those places to break down the animal's paths into transits between the important locations. And the question I really wanted to ask is, what do the animals know about the relationship between these important locations? And so I built a statistical model to look at how those paths become more direct, more linear between locations over time. So to speak a little more specifically, if an animal moves from our location to here, to whatever location that is with a small number, and then it does that exact same transit again, and then it does it again, and then it does it again, does that predict the linearity or the total distance that it travels in order to get between them? And the answer is it does. And so here I've built a nonlinear model of the relationship between the distance between two important locations and the distance the animal traveled to get between them. And the colors of these lines are the predictions of these model based on the experience of the animal, how many times it has made that transit before. And we not only see very distinct decreases in total travel distance with experience, but we see variation between the species in terms of how this is being done. And so to answer this question I want to pose at the end of, do we know what wild animals know? I'm going to suggest that Rousseau forces us to rethink the way I have thought about this the whole time, and to say that animals do not possess knowledge, but that knowledge is partially embodied by an animal, and that knowledge and cognitive agents interact to produce behavior. And so we might say a cognitive agent knows something if models of interaction between the agent and said such knowledge help us predict the behavior of the agent. And finally, that the knowledge of two cognitive agents overlaps if the portions of knowledge embodied in those agents behave similarly in response to objects in the environment. And finally, I come back to this data, this evidence I found, to say that a model of interaction or learning with the inferred mean ends relations that connect trees. So here I'm talking about the idea that I'm inferring that in between are relevant places of interest in the animal's home range, there are sign stimuli it can use to learn how to navigate between these effectively. And using that inference, I have helped me to predict the movement of the animals between these locations. and the knowledge that enables our inferences in this study is distributed across a vast network of scientists, engineers, technology, artifacts, and animals. And I'll end there and take some questions.
Wow, I mean, super, super interesting how you have been applying the features of knowledge. And now I'm super intrigued by the final question about whether animals possess or not knowledge. And I guess I'm going to ask you to ask the question back to you, mm-hmm. in a sense. Because, so one thing that I wanted to do with this characterization of knowledge was not to have a checklist that you have knowledge if and only if all these conditions are satisfied, because there are not even conditions. But clearly one thing that I wanted to do is to put us human epistemic agents in a responsibility position, and so I would have a hard time saying that the machine learning algorithms that we have been discussing earlier on possess knowledge. And I guess one reason is that they are not able to semanticize their own results in the same way as we do. Although we will see whether ChatGPT is able also to attach some semantic meaning about that. Now, the case of animals seems to be different. And now you're really triggering my curiosity, because clearly they do not give semantic meaning in a vernacular form as we do. Mm-hmm. But clearly if they go back to a place, if they react, for instance, looking around for the fruit rather than just taking it, they are attaching some form of meaning. And of course we interpret this as a meaningful action. Okay, so what did you make out of it?
So I think your question points to this argument I wanted to make that I don't think I've fully formed, which is the idea to me that in order to create semantic meaning from the information or from the knowledge that is produced, it requires a sense of a knowledge of the relation between oneself and the world around it. And I think that this model of n-grams, building into episodic memory, building into cognitive maps, suggests that there's features of n-grams that build an animal's capacity for episodic memory, but that it's an inherent feature of the of episodic memory to create a notion of the self, that by situating an agent's present between its recalled past and its projective future, that material thing is the animal self, and its holding of that material is what allows it to build the relations between itself and the world, and thus to apply meaning to the world around it. That's the best I can articulate the argument I have now, but it's why I think that there's a really interesting and important conversation to be had about kind of the nature of this episodic memory and what it implies about the self and its role in determining the meaning an agent can make in the world.
So it is as if it is a form of knowledge, and we share some aspect of the formation and use of this knowledge with some animals at least. And they are agents, but because we have been also very pluralistic about agents as well, so that might explain why we are inclined not to attribute knowledge to an algorithm, but to an animal, provided that we can modulate the form of knowledge that we have or we do not have.
Yes, I think that sums it up well. And I also want to emphasize a distinction I made in, I think, Andrea's talk, which is that something I think that is important in the way that humans and animals engage with the world is the world we engage with does not repeat itself. It's continuous, and everything that we encounter has to be generalized in some way. And so from the get-go, there needs to be a system of relations that if meaning is to be created, connects these disparate ideas. And I think that most of what we have done for artificial agents so far is not embodied. There is a finite set of data, and there are patterns it can find. But, and I think this is where Andrea's work is really interesting, we're still building into a space where we think about the ways that the agent affects the environment, changes the environment, and then relates those changes to itself. And that's where I think that we will start to consider the cognition or the knowledge of artificial agents when we begin to think about it that way.
Then would you like, could you go back to, you had four points, and then you said, okay, we will talk about agency and materiality. That was a very difficult point, you said.
Yes.
And now I think you described kind of this agency as between the past and the future states, right? And this kind of materiality is the physical being that holds between it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. I will think about that some more. Could you then go to one of your last claims? Because I think you made a lot of very big claims at the end.
Yeah, I did.
Which were...
They were very fast, and
yes.
please take them apart for me.
Okay, for the third point, we might say a cognitive agent knows something if models of interaction between the agent and said such knowledge. What do you mean by that?
This is coming from the idea that knowledge is embodied in the world and
okay.
It is distributed. So instead of saying that a agent has the knowledge, we would say it knows something if the material aspects of that knowledge impact its behavior.
So we have here you talk about a cognitive agent, right? So would there be for you a difference between an agent and a cognitive agent?
Yes, in the sense that Federica has I think laid out a case of agency that is predicated primarily on control or impact, in that an epistemic agent, for example, has an impact. It influences the actions of a cognitive agent that is producing knowledge. And so I think that the cognitive agent helps us separate the agent that is actually applying meaning to the information or the knowledge that's created, but is useful to pull apart from the notion of agency as having effect on other objects.
Okay.
And so I'll just add one more little detail to that,
yeah.
Which is that being cognitive affords agency. By creating the ability to predict, one gains agency through the cognitive nature, through cognition.
Thanks, this was super interesting. Just to remark on this slide, and I think it's interesting because it often happens when you have an interaction between, say, the scientists and the philosophers, is that I think in a classical epistemology lingo, you would say that the behavior is indicative of the animal's beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, these may be wrong. And you can test that sometimes by misleading the animal about what's up in nature. And
yes.
Then you would find, we would not say, let's say, that the animal knows something, but the use of knowledge in these various disciplines is different. And I think it's always important to reflect on that, because there is, I mean, completely okay talk of knowledge bases and so on, where this is really goes proxy for information. But I think it's interesting when we reflect on knowledge production in science, where I think it's the more emphatic notion of knowledge that is problematized as something that is not, you know, discovered, but sort of made. But it's not enough for that to have the belief, but it has to be part of a practice. So something is added, but it's not that the justified truth is added, but something else. So that's just it's just a terminological remark. That's all.
Well, I want to say two things to that. And the first is that I really appreciate you noting this, because prior to reading the techno-scientific practices, I don't think I really thought about knowledge mm-hmm. so much in my work. I thought about episodic memory and cognitive mapping and theory of mind, but those didn't manifest to me as in terms of knowledge as much until I read this book. And so these big claims I put up here were kind of a reactionary, mm-hmm. like, all right, I now think of knowledge differently. How can this possibly fit into the way that I think about this work? And I'm really eager and interested to understand these notions in, from different perspectives, because this is all quite new for me. But I also want to highlight another really interesting bit of animal cognition research that's actually Kano, I forget his last name, is at the university here, has been a part of, that showed false belief in great apes, which I think is very, very fascinating, by indicating that they behaved according to the knowledge they could have observed another individual to have, but knew not to be true.
Yeah. So in the last part, yeah, my question is less philosophical, I think, and more technical, maybe. In the last part, when you said that that this correlation that you saw between the time it took for the animals to move from point to point, that changed between species.
Correct.
Do you have an idea why?
Great question. Yes. So let's see if I can sum this up quickly. So I'll start by saying I should laser pointer if folks want to still see me. These are our spider monkeys up in the top left. And you can see that they have the largest impact of experience in terms of the expected travel distance they have. Mm-hmm. And then we also see about equal impacts on the coatis and the kinkajous, with kinkajous maybe potentially having overall lower levels. And then capuchins that have initial distances that are less than coatis, but a smaller learning effect, right? Such that they approach kind of the same asymptote as the coatis. And this actually fits with the prediction we made going into this, which is that the rate at which they would learn these routes would correlate to the degree to which they rely on fruit. And the reason for that is that these fruits in their environment are sort of semi-ephemeral. So a given Dipteryx tree produces a lot of fruit over a period of a couple days, likely. And the Dipteryx trees in this environment are not synchronous. So different trees have large quantities of fruit at different times. And so what this creates is a dynamic system of efficient paths for fruit, where over the course of a few days, the trees that animals ought to be traveling between to get fruit efficiently change. And this is where I hypothesize is driving the formation of more linear routes over a fairly relatively small time scale, right? That these animals have to discover which trees have fruit and then figure out how to get between those trees quickly. And because the spider monkeys and the kinkajous are more dependent on fruit, that is more important to them. Whereas the coatis are a little bit more generalist foragers, so they'll spend time randomly digging in the ground for grubs and other things. And the capuchins are known to be very extractive foragers, so they'll also grab random reptiles, insects, break open nuts. And so I suspect that these animals may be spending a little bit more time on non-fruit-oriented travel, and so our signature of learning is smaller. That suggests that I can't really separate in these effects a motivational versus a learning capacity. And this is a very, very, very challenging and recognized part of this emerging field of ecological cognition, is how do we separate between the motion capacities, the motivation, and the cognition of the animals in determining what's happening with their movement. And what I'll note in this is that moving forward, our goal, you'll notice that we have this map of where the trees are that isn't actually related at all to the map of where I said was important for the animals. And so the next step of this analysis for me is building in features of the environment to understand its interaction with the learning that could reveal potentially what's a motivational component, what's a learning component.
Okay, thanks, yeah, cool.
So what you talked about Tuhlman and his notion of inference, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how I understood it is that you have the, you say the signified and the which terms word means?
The sign object and the signified object, I believe is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, this is from a time of literature studies that I didn't enjoy, so this is great. So they see something and they kind of assume that it's the same structure and that they will get a reward if they follow a certain structure based on the initial state.
It may not even necessarily be the assumption of a reward.
Okay.
But it's that upon experiencing a sign stimulus that is maybe related in some way to other sign stimuli it knows, or the context has changed in which it's observing the sign stimulus, it is creating an expectation for another object it has never specifically encountered before. Maybe that object being in a different place, right? Object here is a very loose term. Yeah. It can be very abstract.
A different kind of fruit or...
Yes.
Yes. So this kind of makes me wonder if this is kind of counterfactual reasoning. Right? Could you see it like this also to you and to the philosophers?
Perhaps. To be honest, I don't have a great sense of what counterfactual reasoning is, but I skipped over my little section on inference, and so maybe I'll go back to that. I went too far. And see if this helps us build a common understanding of what you mean by counterfactual, which is...
so much slides.
I know, sorry. Well, there's just a lot of animations. Here we go, on the slides. So in this study, I gave a series of primates, including Socrates, our capuchin monkey here, the ability to access information in different ways, as illustrated on this diagram on the right. So there's food hidden under these cups.
Yeah.
And through training, Socrates has learned that she has one shot to pick the cup with the food in it. And in some cases, we give her partial information about where it is by removing the option of it being under a certain cup,
yes,
right? In other cases, we give her direct perceptual access to the food. And in a final case, we give her complete information about where the food is not. And we're suggesting in this study that she has not ever seen the raisin under this cup in that final scenario, but she acts as if she knows it is there by selecting that cup. And we did this study with five different species of animals, and the macaque species in this study were generally able to do this inference by exclusion. The capuchin monkeys, they couldn't do it with a three-cup case. But if we reduced it down to two and we showed them the one empty cup, they would make that inference. And there's plenty of debate in the literature about kind of the role of procedural memory in this versus the role of, say, episodic memory or a cognitive map, right? Because how different is the 15 times that we pick up the empty cup from each other? And is there enough procedural memory in pick the cup that isn't picked up for Socrates to make the correct choice without inferring the location of the raisin? But we make the argument that each context is different. I will now make the argument, this is a little bit post hoc as I've built on these ideas, right? But that the part of the reason we see kind of the difference in how many cups matters to a species is their ability to extrapolate between more and more and more different scenarios, right? And so the inference in this two-cup scenario is simple enough that it can make that inference, but it is still an inference because it has not seen that specific reason in that specific place before.
Okay. But you said in the final situation, but in the final one, would it still pick up the third cup? No, right?
Well, this is kind of one of our controls, right? Which is to say, yeah, it's requiring a combination of features. It doesn't just, the Socrates isn't just picking up a cup that we picked up, because no. We can pick up the wrong cup and she won't take it. We can pick up the right cup and the wrong cup and she'll pick the right cup, right? So we're basically trying to make as many combinations of salient features as possible here to suggest that they're combining elements of the environment to make conclusions about where the food is. And we've shown that the different species of primates are essentially able to accommodate a different quantity of competing features to make this inference.
Would you call that a gadget or not? That they learn a kind of gadget here?
A gadget?
Yeah, a kind of combination of, or context that they work in. Like of the three cups always having one raisin, or two cups and one raisin?
I wouldn't say so, but because of what Sander is saying of every, first because I don't see it as a sequential thing in a sense.
Okay.
And second, because of the thing of establishing, so here the idea is that the animal establishes like relations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Learning to do the best thing and then extracting what it's all the time doing in learning to do the best thing. It's more kind of the other way around in the sense of like building relationships.
So to complicate this idea a little bit of the
right.
Sequential part, the last part of this study, which you can kind of see an effect here, is that when we first did this inference, the surface of the platform it was on was opaque. And then after we demonstrated the ability of these primates to make inferences, we used a plexiglass clear bottom, meaning that in some cases, we would not give them any information at all. We would not lift any cups, or we would lift the one and give them partial information. And our test there was whether they would scooch down and seek out more information about where the food was. And again, we saw species level differences where I think we ended up testing 8 capuchin monkeys and about half of them passed our inference test. And Socrates was the only one who significantly modulated her search based on the availability of information. So she would look when she didn't know and she would grab when she did. Even when she was only able to know through inference, she could grab without looking for the food.